Welcome back to the Extra Movie Butter Podcast, where every week your Extra Movie Butter boys break down the weekend box office, your movie news, your new releases, and of course our favorite segment, the Extra Movie Butter segment, where we break down our favorite movies for whatever topic we choose. We've just learned, folks, and happy 2024, that we are the number one podcast in Liechtenstein. So all of you Liechtensteinians, Liechtensteins, thank you. We love you. Keep tuning in. I am your host today, Mark the Moose Haas. And of course, I'm joined by my two illustrious co-hosts, Benny Hamlin and JTE. And we're, as a fun extra for today, we're bringing on our good buddy, Mike Deacon. We're reviewing the Iron Claw. He's a big wrestling fan, but also he holds a big place in our hearts. Mike, welcome to the show, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. I do have a bone to pick with one of you before we get going. And Moose, I listened to last week's podcast, and you had some words about a certain movie that I needed to confront. How dare you deface the name of Cocaine Bear?
Mike, we are watching a totally different movie. Cocaine Bear is horrible, and you know it's horrible.
But I beg to differ, but no, it's wonderful to be here. And yeah, this is a movie that, like, when they announced the movie, I was like, this would be a perfect one for me to go on and tell, because I knew the story coming in. When we get to this, the Von Erich story is fascinating, and this is one that I definitely was on my most anticipated movies of the year, so very excited to be here to talk about it.
And before all of you start pulling out your pitchfork and torches and start saying that, hey, wait a minute, this is a 2023 movie, we know that. Do you know what came out this week? Nothing. So we're going to go with the 2023 movie to kick off 2024, all right?
At least it went wide now. You know, it was in New York and L.A., but now it's at least wide. And I have something in common with Mike. I have a bone to pick with Benny and Moose after last week's episode. I re-listened to it, and I didn't stand up for it in the moment, and I felt bad after re-listening to our episode. You guys both had Expendables 4 on your worst of list. Not a bad movie. Not horrible. Not as good as the first three.
Benny, it was god awful.
Benny, you gave it a pretty positive review when we did our episode together. You weren't that negative on it.
Then I was really drunk, because that movie is awful.
Okay, I'm just going to say it right now. JT, I think you've been replaced. You're a Skrull. What the hell are you thinking?
You know what's sad? I know it's not as good as the first three. I know it's not great. But Dolph Lundgren, even as a little bit of Stallone and Statham, my love for that genre and those guys just goes beyond bad movies. It's like a relative. My relative makes Hootie Tang. I'm still going to say, good job, buddy. That was a good movie.
I don't know. There are certain crimes when your relative commits them. You just got to let them go to prison and not write them anymore, man.
I'm 100% with Benny on that.
I thought the whole scene on the boat towards the end with, like, the motorcycle, there's some cool stuff in there. Like, it wasn't totally a miss for me. That's all I'm saying. Although I will say Cocaine Bear was pretty awful.
Okay, well, shots fired already on this episode. But we're going to move forward, and we're going to move forward as we do with the movie box office results from this previous weekend. So coming in at number one, Wonka. Another $14 million on its $164 million run so far. I found Wonka delightful. I'm glad to see it's got some good legs. Number two was Night Swim. This was the first week that it came out. Again, folks, did you want us to review Night Swim or did you want us to review the Iron Claw? We're going to go with the Iron Claw. Number three, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, down 42% at $100 million so far domestically. So it's not completely tanking as I think we all kind of projected it would. But still, you got to figure there was $200 million at least dumped into that movie. Number four, Migration. With $9.9 million. Number five, Anyone But You. The Glenn Powell led Anyone But You with $9.7 million. This one was a bit of a surprise. The Boys in the Boat with $5.5 million coming in at number six. The Color Purple down 60% at number seven with $4.6 million. The Iron Claw in wide release now, $4.5 million brings it at number eight. Number nine is Ferrari with $2.4 million. Again, got to think that that's probably a bit of a disappointment. And number 10, Benny's favorite movie of the year, Poor Things, with $1.9 million. Gentlemen, I have thrown out the numbers. It's time for you to tell me what you think the box office tells you. And Mike, you're our guest. We're going to kick off with you, buddy. Take it away.
So I actually fall into what I was going to bring up. The one that jumped out to me is that Anyone But You is actually gaining as it's been going along. Its numbers have actually gone up. I'm guilty of seeing it the third weekend myself, so I definitely contributed to this. Having seen the movie, I guess I kind of understand why its appeal is growing, because it really is a pretty carefree, turn your brain off, go have a fun, you know, 90 minutes with a charming Glenn Powell. But I'm surprised to see, because it's not common these days, that a movie, especially that came out Christmas week, is actually doing better as it goes along. So that was something I found very fascinating this week.
It is up 11% from last week. Good call. JT, what does the tale of the numbers tell you?
That's interesting what Mike just brought up about Anyone But You. For me, it's like Christmas just gets, you get unloaded with a bunch of movies, and that's not the type of movie you're going to go see with your family. So I think once, you know, all the adults went home, had a New Year's party, and they're like, all right, let's go out to the movies and, you know, get over this hangover, then that makes sense why that movie kind of went up a little bit. Let's go see Anyone But You. Night Swim did pretty good. I was wondering how it was going to do. The Blumhouse loves dropping these January, February horror films. And I know a few people who saw the movie and says it's kind of a fun movie. It's not horrible, because I was expecting it to be horrible. So it's a movie I don't know if I'll make out to the theater to see, but it's definitely, I'll definitely watch the second it hits like Peacock or something. I think that's where all his movies go to. I think they go to Peacock or Hulu, one of those two. But I'm definitely going to check it out, because horror films, genre films, you know, that's something that's big around this time. January is usually the dumpster month, but sometimes, you know, you'll find, you know, a half-eaten eclair in the dumpster and you'll take a bite. That's a Seinfeld reference, if you don't know.
I understand that reference. Well done. Benny, how about you, buddy? What does the tale of the box office numbers tell you, my friend?
One, I would like to point out that nearly 3 weeks ago, before Aquaman ever came out, I pointed out that I thought it would win the box office with $40 million and then Wonka would overtake it in its second week. And that happened because I'm a box office icon. Wonka, it is a movie that is easily digestible by a large swath of humanity. And so it's not surprising that it has great January legs. The Color Purple, I think a lot of people will fall into the category like I am, in that I do not see in my head how that movie lends itself to a musical. It may be a fabulous musical, but knowing the movie that came out in the 80s, it's not something I'm going to pay to see set to music. And so I think all the people that were going to see that have went out to see that, and everyone else is going to either see it on streaming, unless it gets a huge Oscar push when the nominations come out, then it may see a little revival. And also, it proves that whenever, you know, it's an election year and the Green Party starts having its nominations, and afterwards people just need to throw on their skinny jeans and have a Merlot and pay $10 to watch some dog shit, that Poor Things is there for them. And they can go out and see that god awful piece of trash.
Wow. Maybe I went too far with announcing that Poor Things was your favorite movie, but I like Mike. One of my first notes when I was taking a look at the box office numbers was Anyone But You gaining some steam, right? Listen, those two, Sydney Sweeney, Glenn Powell, they're too charming. They're two beautiful people. No kidding. They're doing well. I'm glad to see that. Mike, did you care for the movie? Like, was it like an enjoyable movie?
It's one of those movies that, like, I didn't have a strong opinion of either way. Like, probably a month from now, I probably will remember very little from it. There's a handful of laugh-out-loud moments, but as a whole, it's kind of eh. Glenn Powell carries it from his charisma, but the story as a whole, you could predict the whole thing. You know, you can see three steps ahead the entire way.
Fair. I was shocked to see that The Color Purple had such a steep drop off to 60%. I thought that might have better legs. I am curious. I am still planning on seeing that one in theaters. Ferrari, I did see, was very disappointed by the movie. Not surprised that the movie is not doing well. $98 million budget, and so far it's made $25 million worldwide. I even thought, like, well, Ferrari will make its money back in Europe and Italy and places where Ferrari's a more prominent name. Not so much. So kind of sad to see a Michael Mann movie going down like that. But other than that, look, I'm happy to see Wonka continue to make money. $14 million is nothing to shy at. I enjoyed Wonka. I thought it was quite charming. I thought it was a delightful little movie. So, hey, as long as movies that are coming out, you know, which usually in January are not very good movies, Wonka's got a chance to continue to earn some money.
Speaking of movies that came out, I actually did get a chance to see Society of Snow, which was the number one film for Jeff Snyder when we did our top 10. It came out Thursday of last week, so I was like, okay. I came home from work. We threw on the project. We even threw on the projector because we wanted the big screen. And I thought it was okay. I understand why Jeff had a lot of fondness for it. It is a beautifully shot film. I think that director, Jay Boyona, doesn't know how to shoot anything but a beautiful movie. All his films look fantastic. Monsters Call, The Impossible. Even, you know, I didn't like Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, but it was well shot. I'll give it that. My issue with this is, like, I grew up watching the Ethan Hawke film from the early 90s, Alive. Yep. And I think this is obviously a much better shot film, has better effects, has better just production value from head to toe. My issue is there's no real lead character in this film. So the original, Ethan Hawke's kind of the character you attach yourself to. And he's the one you really kind of see going through it. And yes, there's the side characters also that you understand what they're going through. This movie never really fully attached itself to one character. And because of that, I never really felt like I got to know any of the characters or like their psyche or like personally. Like it felt a little bit like I had a little bit of distance from them. What they're going through is still harrowing and horrific. And it's a very interesting film on that level. But a movie about survival, you want to, no, you know, I don't know. There was something missing and I can't quite put my finger on it, but I wasn't as fully invested as I wanted to be. I wasn't as fully invested as I was in the original film. When Ethan Hawke says, you know, I don't know how to spoil the movie, but when he's like makes choices in that film, I understand why he made those choices, but it's more, and they were more motivated emotionally and character driven. Whereas this film, it feels like more of just a straight up survival movie. Like this is a, You ever see that show, I Shouldn't Be Alive? This is the most artistic I Shouldn't Be Alive movie episode ever shot with like a $100 million budget. So I highly recommend checking it out. I still think everybody should watch it because it's so well shot, so well acted. Just maybe that issue I had won't be there for you guys. So I definitely do recommend checking it out. It's on Netflix right now. I will say it's also a little too long. It's 2.5 hours. Could have been like an hour 50. Go ahead, Benny.
Yeah, one random thing that just popped into my head that I didn't mention earlier. I think a lot of what's causing the color purple to fade right now is Wonka. That Wonka is in the exact same lane, that musical lane, but it is much more digestible. You know, you're not going in thinking that there's as a much emotional weight in it. And I think if you're just going looking for a fun, uplifting musical, Wonka is going to be your choice, which I think is also cutting the legs out from under the color purple. And I would also like to apologize for anyone that regularly votes Green Party. Just so you know, even though I don't believe in the environment in any way, I do frequently vote Green Party. I was doing it for humor's sake. You are loved on our channel. But people that wear skinny jeans, fuck you.
Fair enough. All right. Well, I will say this, JT, I did watch May, December. That was one of your top movies.
Yeah, my number 8, I think.
While I absolutely agree with the performances being outstanding in that movie, I didn't really care too much for the movie.
Let me ask you this. Is it because the movie doesn't have a beginning, middle, end? It's more like you are spending this much time this weekend with these three characters. So there's not really a traditional plot. It's really just three street characters, their interactions, and the things that kind of bubble up to the surface. So really, the movie is about emotion, dealing with past trauma, and these three different characters are kind of thrown together and are made to reveal things. So I'm curious, like, what about the movie didn't work for you? Was it didn't have a plot? Didn't really have a structure? Or was it you just didn't like where it ended up?
Yeah, I understand like how movies work, JT.
Yeah. I know, but that's when you said that. That's the first thing that maybe came to my mind. Like maybe what you didn't like about it.
I don't know. I just didn't care for the whole cat and mouse at the end. The last like maybe 30 to 45 minutes of the movie just kind of fall apart a little bit for me. I understand like the motivation and everything behind like Natalie Portman's character and why she's doing what she's doing, what she's doing in the movie. And that's interesting enough for me. But the actual relationships and how they all end at the end of the movie just kind of ruined the last like 45 minutes of it. I was on board until maybe there was one particular thing that happened in the movie that just kind of almost like started to snowball effect for me. Oh, but I will, okay. I don't want to spoil too much for our listeners because we haven't reviewed that movie, but
we'll take it offline. So I guess some specifics, because I'm curious to hear what you say.
I will say this, that the performances are outstanding, and you're right. The male lead in that movie definitely steals the movie.
So good.
Yes, he's great. I'm sorry I don't have it pulled up because I have my next set of notes pulled up, and that is the Golden Globe Award winners. So I figured we'd talk very quickly because a lot of times, I mean, our good friends over at Bite Size Breakdown put up the statistics on their website, bitesizebreakdown.com, and then, of course, on Twitter about how often Golden Globe winners turn around and revert and win the Oscars. And the probability between Golden Globe, like Best Picture winner, and then the Academy Award Best Picture winner is usually pretty staggeringly high. So even if these fine people who won awards last night don't go on to win Oscars, we're still proud of the accomplishments that they made because a lot of our favorites actually won Golden Globes last night. Now, I watched the opening, just the opening dialogue from Joe Coy. It was not very good. I understand the criticism of him in this on that show. And I got to tell you, it's tough, I think, to be a Golden Globes winner or Golden Globes host. So I'm just saying that. But let's talk a little bit about some of the top winners here. Best Director went to Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer. We all had Oppenheimer, I think, in our top 10. Mike, was it in yours as well?
So I did my top 10 a little bit differently this year. If you heard mine, I did it by what I was most likely to rewatch. So from that perspective, it was not, but if you were talking on a pure filmmaking level, absolutely. Yes.
Fair enough. Best animated movie went to The Boy and the Heron. A lot of buzz around that one. Best drama went to Oppenheimer. Best motion picture, musical or comedy, went to Poor Things.
Poor shit.
Anatomy of a Fall was one that Benny had in his top that went to Best Non-English Language Movie. Best Original Score went to Oppenheimer. Ludwig Göransson, not Hans. Oh my God, I'm drawing a blank. I keep wanting to say Hans Zimmer. Christian Andersen.
Hans Zimmer.
Best Original Song went to What I Was Made For. That was Billie Eilish, Phineas O'Connell. I think everybody kind of saw that one coming too. We're going to skip past some of the TV performances because this is a movie podcast, folks. Best performance by a female actor in a motion picture went to Lily Gladstone. Very well deserved. We just rewatched Killers of the Flower Moon last night.
That's impressive that you got through that twice.
Best performance by a female actor in a comedy or musical, Emma Stone in Poor Things.
Yep.
I wish you could see my face as I just look at Benny and announce the accolades for Poor Things. Best performance by a female actor in a supporting role in any motion picture went to Divine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers. Yes. Yes. Well, well, well deserved. Oh, that's Elizabeth Debicki for The Crown. Come on now. We don't care about The Crown, Beef, Succession. Best male performance or best performance by a male actor in a motion picture went to Cillian Murphy. Drama. Now, for a best male actor for a musical or comedy went to Paul Giamatti. This leads me to think that this is a two-horse race for best Oscar winner, and I feel like it is going to be between Cillian Murphy and Paul Giamatti. Best performance by a male in a supporting role went to Robert Downey Jr. I think it's his to lose, Shane, for Oscar. If we continue to go through, we have... I had these all organized, and then my computer decided to reset.
I think you got all the roles. You got the big
and then
ones.
The last, the cinematic and box office achievement, of course, went to Barbie. They had to give it to Barbie.
The makeup award.
It's the top grossing movie of the year.
It's just a bet. That award is just to get stars and seats. That's all that award is about.
That's right. So I apologize for the delay, gentlemen. I threw out a lot of winners. Give me your take. JT, kick us off, buddy.
Yeah, I think a lot of this went the way we thought it was going to. I think Lily Gladstone is pretty much a shoo-in for Best Actress. I think the lady from The Holdovers is a shoo-in for Best Supporting Actress. I think Best Supporting Actor is pretty much a lock for Robert Downey Jr. I agree with you, Moose. Basically, the only real tight race in my eyes as of right now is the Giamatti-Oppenheimer-Cillian Murphy race. Because Cillian Murphy's been around for a long time, but he's never really the lead. He's always been a character supporting actor. Paul Giamatti is much beloved in Hollywood, has been around for a long time. It could be one of those, let's give him the Oscar at towards the end of his career kind of awards, which the Academy loves to do. And the Academy, you know, a lot of people, critics in the Academy love The Holdovers. So I don't know what else The Holdovers could win. It could win screenplay, obviously, also. It's going to win that Best Supporting Actress. But I could see this being the one big award that The Holdovers walks away with. And they give basically Oppenheimer all the technical awards. They'll give it the Best Picture. They'll give it Best Director. But they might give Paul Giamatti the Best Actor. So I think that's a two-way race. I think most of the other categories, for the most part, are pretty much decided to a point. I mean, again, it's early in the Oscar season. Anything could happen. I think Emma Stone definitely just does give her a little bit of momentum. But it's still Lily Gladstone's to lose, honestly.
So I will say this. Like, as much as I did not like the movies as a whole of Killers of the Flower Moon and Poor Things, that had nothing to do with the performances in either of those movies. The actors brought it in all of those movies. So I won't, redo my reviews. So I would say that typically, I never really agree with what comes out of the award ceremonies. But for me, this is almost chalk. Like, I actually really like what they did. So I have no complaints here. I had, Oppenheimer, I thought was one of the best movies of the year. When we talked about The Holdovers, like, we all said that, her name just jumped right out of my mind.
Joy Randolph.
Yeah, that her performance was one of the best of the year. Lily Gladstone is the only redeeming quality of Killers of the Flower Moon. She outshined like 10 Hollywood icons in that movie and by a fair margin. So, like I said, I don't think there is anything that you can argue about here. It went chalk. It went like it should. And so I'm actually pretty pleased with these, and I'm not an awards person.
Yeah, so my big take was I was very happy to see The Holdovers win both those awards. Like all of you said last week, that was the movie probably I felt the most like pure joy and warmth and happiness walking out of. And Divine Joy Randolph was so good in that movie. It does not matter who is nominated. That's one of the best supporting actress performances in years, not just this year. She did that well. I really enjoyed her performance. And Paul Giamatti just... everything about that guy with everything that happened last night after he won the award and everything surrounding him as a whole, just as an actor, who doesn't love Paul Giamatti? Like, seriously, throughout the years, that's one of my favorite actors that I've seen forever. You know, I remember the first time I visited, my memories of going to a movie was Man on the Moon. And ever since then, I've always enjoyed Paul Giamatti. And he's also been like a hero to my podcast crew. We all love Giamatti. We're all pulling for him. I know Cillian Murphy is probably the front runner, and he was excellent. Don't get me wrong. I really liked Cillian Murphy in Oppenheimer, but I'm all in for Giamatti this year.
Yeah, I think I speak for everyone, and I agree 100% with you, Mike. I think everyone on this, at least on this panel here, is pulling for Giamatti to take the win. I agree with JTE. I think that Giamatti's been around a little bit longer. Cillian Murphy's just starting to get himself some lead roles. I mean, the dude has been putting on good performances for a long time. He's just always been a side character. Giamatti had a previous Oscar nomination for Cinderella Man, which I still think to this day is one of the greatest performances ever given as Russell Crowe's manager in that movie.
Criminally underrated sports movie. Criminally.
100% agreed. Yes, if you're looking for just a great overcome the odds sports movie, go watch Cinderella Man, directed by Ron Howard. Now, Divine Joy Randolph, I agree. I think that she's a shoe-in. I am curious. I actually feel like I'm going to give the edge to Lily Gladstone over Emma Stone. Not because Emma Stone put out a terrible performance, but because Emma Stone has won before. We've seen her put out great performances time and time and time again. Doesn't mean that she shouldn't continue to win the Oscars, but I do think that you have an opportunity to give an Oscar to somebody who frankly took a 3.5-hour movie and just injected life and carried that movie. I hate to say that because you had such performances from Leo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, but at the same time, like, I just wanted more of Lily Gladstone's character in that movie. And I think if you can steal the thunder away from names like that, you absolutely deserve to win it. Yeah, I think it's Oppenheimer is going to be best picture of the year. Well, I have some fun movie news for you guys. And I wrote one of these stories specifically because our very own JT has a very personal connection to one of these stories. But we have two kind of low-key action movies that have been greenlit for sequels. The first one is The Accountant 2. If you remember, The Accountant starred Ben Affleck. And that one's going to start shooting this year. And then the second one starring Bob Odenkirk was called Nobody. And Nobody 2 has now been confirmed. Now, I'm going to turn it over. I'm going to let JT kick us off on this one because JTE actually did stunt training and film scenes for the movie Nobody, correct?
Yeah, it was something me and Craig the Barbarian, Craig Gaynor, friend of the show, we got to go together. And I got to, you know, I'll give it to Craig. He did better than I did. Just because I've seen every action movie ever made doesn't mean once you're thrown into the, you know, crossfire and bar stools and broken glass of bar fights, just doesn't mean you're going to translate. I wish all these years of watching action movies would translate to me being an action hero, but Craig filled the role better than I did. He just, look at the guy. He's a barbarian. So I don't know. It was fun. It was cool. It was on the Universal lot. It was a pretty fun little thing we did just for a promotion during the Schmodown. I like Nobody. I like the first film. This definitely has that John Wick vibe to it. I think the sequel, listen, you give me more Bob Odenkirk, I'm going to be there. The guy is the best. I love Bob Odenkirk. Been a fan of his since back in Mr. Show, Bob and David, whatever. Mr. Show. It's just called Mr. Show, but then it was like, what Bob do? So I'm there for that. And what was the other sequel?
Accountant.
That's a weird one because I don't think the movie like set the box office on fire, but I think it did really well in home video and like rentals. So I think it's one of those movies kind of like the original Austin Powers. People forget the original Austin Powers did not do well in theaters. It was home video where it really made its claim and really became profitable. And then when the sequel came out, everyone rushed to see it because they've all seen the home video. I don't know if the count it kind of falls in that, like, all of us are a huge movie buffs. We all hang out with our people who are huge movie buffs. I don't remember the count ever really getting brought up. I thought the original was fine. Gavin O'Connor directed it, who's I'm a big fan of his. I love Warrior. I talked about it on the podcast a couple weeks ago. I just don't know who's clamoring for an accountant too. So maybe they're out there. I just haven't met them. That's all I can say.
So I will say this. In your defense, that scene that you filmed with Craig, I don't necessarily know if Craig did better than you. There was a scene where you hit and killed a guy with a frying pan and then licked the frying pan. If yes, that doesn't say action star, I don't know what does.
My improv skills may be better than Craig's. I'm just saying the actual physicality he was better at. But if you're asking for a little bit of flair, a little Bruce Lee action, you know, that's me. I'll give you the little extra flair.
In Craig's defense, too, he did have that, like, fur of the pelt Elvis with him the whole time. So I can make a case for either one of you. I'll speak to these movies. I just watched Nobody, like, maybe 6 months ago, and I dug it. I had a good time with it. I mean, look, if I can get, I only know Bob Odenkirk as a funny man, and so if I can see funny men become action stars, then I, like JT, can believe that at some point in my life, I too can become an action star. So I dug it. The accountant, like all of you are saying, it was fine. I mean, it ended, yes, okay. So John Bernthal, spoiler for a movie, I don't know what, 2018, 2017. So John Bernthal is revealed at the end of the movie to be his brother. So I am imagining that you're going to get more Bernthal, and I'm imagining you're going to get more Affleck together, right? So you got the Punisher and you got Daredevil teaming up. That's basically, I mean, this guy can't go back to an accounting job. Like, he basically killed every single person who knew that he existed and then left a bloody mess behind him. So I don't imagine that this job, this guy's going to just be showing up and doing somebody's taxes and then going on another like hitman mission. So I am a little curious to see how the plot of that goes, but yeah, sign me up for Nobody Too. At the end of the movie, it was like everyone in Bob Odenkirk's family, Christopher Lloyd, RZA, they were all like a family of assassins. That intrigues me. Give me more Christopher Lloyd with a shotgun. That was awesome.
I am excited to see a sequel for Nobody. Like, I really, really enjoyed the first one. I have extreme doubts about the movie's marketability because it was a pandemic release, which narrowed greatly how many people are aware of that movie. And Bob Odenkirk is not a name that you're going to put on a movie's marquee anyway, that I think is going to draw people in. So, like, even though I am personally super excited to see a Nobody 2, I think there is a high bomb factor with that movie. Like, The Accountant 2, I can tell you right now, no one's going to go and see that movie. Like, I really like the first Accountant. But even though I really liked it, when you said they're making an Accountant too, I was like, Accountant, what the hell is that? And it took me like a minute to pull that. Oh, yeah, I saw that movie. It was pretty good. And Ben Affleck, despite the fact that he is a known name, like when he is not connected to a known IP, he has not been drawing people in the last few years. Like, a lot of his movies, especially his action movies, go to the movie graveyard to die. So I am almost positive The Accountant 2 will bomb. But like I said, I am interested in seeing both of these sequels, but I don't think either of them has good prospects for making money.
I'll let you go.
What I was going to say with The Accountant 2 is that screams to me of a movie that would thrive as a direct to streaming movie. Like, because I don't think that's going to get people coming out to the box to go and actually see it in theaters. But if Amazon Prime or Netflix gets that and promotes it, they will get pretty decent numbers for something of that nature, especially with the Ben Affleck in it. But same as Benny said, like, I saw that when it came out in theaters, and when we brought it up earlier, I had to pick my brain to remember what that movie was.
Yeah, it wasn't very memorable. I forgot Bernthal was even in the movie until Moose mentioned it. I said, oh yeah, until I forgot about that. My thing about Nobody too is it's low risk, high reward. First film did not cost a lot. It's kind of following the Blumhouse model. Let's make high concept, low budget, and hope that it hits a chord with audiences. So I think Nobody too, as long as they don't double up the budget, I think they'll be fine. They'll make their money just, you know, on streaming and rentals alone, probably.
Well, I'm going to bring up one last topic because I feel like this topic might be a little divisive. There's a few of us that very much appreciate this, and I feel like everyone on this appreciates a good Leslie Nielsen comedy. So I find it very interesting that Seth MacFarlane is finally greenlit and has a scriptwriter for his Naked Gun series reboot, starring Liam Neeson as Detective Frank Drebin. Now, I know my man Benny over here is a big police or Naked Gun from the police files fan here. So I'm going to let you kick us off. What is your thoughts on Liam Neeson, A, showing up as Detective Frank Drebin, and then B, having a Naked Gun series reboot directed by Seth MacFarlane?
There are few ideals that come together so poorly as this concept. I am so disappointed by this news. One, I am not a Seth MacFarlane fan. I'm not a Family Guy fan. don't like the Ted movies. A Thousand Ways to Die in the West is god awful. He's just not my cup of tea when it comes to humor. And so him taking over like a beloved franchise from my early teens is painful in itself. And but in itself, like the Naked Gun movies are they're a unique late 80s, early 90s genre that will be very hard to transfer to the modern social landscape, because like our current society does not lend itself well to straight out parody. That's just how I feel about it. And also like Leslie Nielsen and O.J. Simpson and Ned Beatty, they were all very uniquely perfect for that. And, you know, Ned Beatty, Leslie Nielsen are gone. You can't really use O.J. anymore, although Seth MacFarlane probably will because he's an asshole. But that being said, this just all seems like it's going to be a painful train wreck. I will say this, though, and it's positive. I think Liam Neeson has underrated comedic abilities, and I think he could probably pull off this role, but I think this is going to be an absolute just garbage fest.
So not Ned Beatty. I think you're meaning George
Kennedy. Yeah. Sorry. I'm literally racking my brain like, was Ned Beatty in The Naked Gun?
I'm so sorry.
I was like, okay, thank you, Moose, for that correction, because I was losing my mind over here.
That's okay. I'll chime in next with my – so the Naked Gun movies are like – there was a little bit when the Wayans brothers were being able to like put out spoof movies. You had like Scary Movie. You had Scary Movie 2. So you were getting kind of these like spoof type movies. I don't – like it really hasn't been too much of a thing of like maybe the last 10 or 15 years. I appreciate Liam Neeson. I think he's amazing, but he's not Leslie Nielsen. Like Leslie Nielsen had something that worked. You would look at like, even like the misses, like Dracula Dead and Loving It. And the best part of that movie is Leslie Nielsen. I feel like the Naked Gun movies are a product of their time. I love these movies. I love Detective Frank Drebin. I love just, to your point, Benny, just the parody of parody. Like, it's so much fun to watch these movies and to continue to go back. The first one had Ricardo Montalban as the main, I must kill. The Queen had Reggie Jackson. They played at an Angels game, for crying out loud. Like, I love the Naked Gun movies. I am curious to see Liam Neeson do comedy. I mean, I've seen him do like a couple of comedic roles here or there. I also think that Seth MacFarlane at this point is Seth MacFarlane. Like, if you enjoy his humor, you're all in for his next venture. But I also think that he's played his hand. We all know what he's going to play. There's not really any point in if you don't enjoy his humor at this point anymore, there's no point in continuing to watch his movies. I think he's played out. I've had enough of the Family Guy type humor. A Million Ways to Die in the West, I used to like think that was funny. I rewatched it and was like, this movie's awful. So again, like if this were someone else other than Seth MacFarlane, I would totally be on board with Liam Neeson playing Detective Frank Drebin. I would be super curious to see how he played that. But because it's this, I'm out.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and sound like it's going to sound like a broken record here, but I'm with basically Moose and Benny. I think Liam Neeson is a great choice. I think he, because what Frank Drebin does, or Leslie Nielsen, they deliver these lines with a stone cold seriousness, no matter how ridiculous they are. And I think Liam Neeson could tap into that. You know, one of my favorite jokes with Naked Gun, he's like a blind man at an orgy, I'm going to feel this one out. I'm just like, those lines are just so great. And I could see Liam Neeson just delivering that stone cold funny. It is. I feel like it's kind of a lost art form, like you're saying, Moose. These movies aren't really made anymore. I remember movies like Loaded Weapon with Emilio Estevez and Samuel Jackson. That was a whole Lethal Weapon spoof. I love that movie. John Lovitz is in it. It has more cameos than you can imagine. Go back and watch that movie. You'll be surprised how many famous people show up in that movie. My big thing is Seth MacFarlane. I don't trust him at all with this property. I'm sure he loves the originals. Outside of the first Ted, I haven't liked any of his films. I didn't really like Ted 2. I thought Million Ways to Die was horrible. So to me, great casting, the perfect choice to take on this role. I just don't believe in the creatives that are behind it. So therefore it's hard for me to get excited for it.
Yeah. So the one thing I wanted to say here, I'll start with Liam Neeson. If anybody is familiar with the show Life's Too Short with Warwick Davis that was on HBO a few years back, he comes in and does an improvisational comedy bit, just stop what you're doing when you finish listening to this and go find that scene, because it's one of the funniest scenes you're going to ever listen to or watch. It's so
I have full-blown AIDS.
Yeah.
that's the line from that sketch. I agree, Mike. Great point. I love that episode. And that's a great example of somebody saying ridiculously funny things stone cold serious. Sorry,
exactly. Go ahead, Mike. So I think he can pull that off. The issue is that he's playing Frank Drebin. That is Leslie Nielsen. Now, I don't like them making another Police Academy movie. Not Police Academy, duh. Naked Gun. Yeah, might as well be a Police Academy movie. Naked Gun, though, is like, you can do that, but give him a different character name. He doesn't have to be Frank Drebin. Like, go somewhere else with it. Liam Neeson can definitely do this type of humor, but this is Leslie Nielsen's role. Don't take that away from him. Don't dilute it.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well, before we bring Enrico Palazzo on to sing us off, we are going to take a break. Up next, because we are reviewing a wrestling movie, we will be talking about our favorite movies that feature wrestlers. Stay tuned.
Sergeant Frank Drebin, Detective Lieutenant Police Squad.
Yeah, and I'm Robert De Niro.
Mr. De Niro, we've got to get inside.
It's action-packed.
I know what I'm doing.
Full-bodied.
What are you doing in my bathing suit?
Star-studded. Leslie Nielsen.
You're so insensitive.
This isn't that toilet seat thing again, is it?
Naked Gun, 33 and a third.
Freeze and nobody gets hurt.
The final insult.
From now on.
Rated PG-13. Now playing at theaters everywhere. Hulk Hogan is Chef Ramsay. He takes no nonsense.
He's yours.
He pulls no punches.
My cat.
And he leaves no stone unturned.
That's not my cat.
Oh. Because this time, he's more than the Hulkster. He's Suburban Commando. Oh. Hulk Hogan, Christopher Lloyd, Suburban Commando. Rated PG. Starts Friday, October 4th at a theater near you.
Welcome back, folks. Now, our favorite segment, the extra movie butter. Now, we're reviewing the Iron Claw, which means that we need to be talking about a little bit of wrestling. What goes with wrestling? Wrestlers. How many times have wrestlers been in movies? Let's find out. Let's find out our favorites. So, Mike, again, you're our guest. Why don't you kick us off with your favorite movie featuring a wrestler?
So, I'm going to give two, and they're both going to be, you know, from a little ways back. The first one I'm going to go with stars the wrestler George the Animal Steele as Tor Johnson in Ed Wood, which Ooh. I think a lot of people forget that you know, George the Animal Steele was in that movie. His resemblance to Tor Johnson is just uncanny in that film. Obviously, he's not like the lead in the role, but it's one of those movies that I think Ed Wood was such a labor of love towards something so iconically bad that movie spoke to me on a level that a lot of movies don't. To see something of that prestige, because I got so many, you know, we were talking about awards movies that had a lot of awards buzz. It didn't win everything, but you know, it had a lot of buzz when it came out. And George the Animal Steele played it, you know, was a bit role in the movie, but it was such a fun role and he was perfect in it. Now the other one, I can't do any kind of show with Benny without this coming up. And of course, that is our favorite beloved R.I.P. Wallace Shawn, the Princess Bride.
Yes. Featuring Andre the Giant. Yes.
Yeah, I had to go with that. Andre the Giant in that movie as Fezzik it was delightful. That is such a perfectly cast role for Andre the Giant. And the movie, I mean, that's one of who in their right mind doesn't like The Princess Bride? That's such a perfect movie as a whole. And this is both of those that I mentioned were kind of before the explosion of when a lot of wrestlers, minus Hulk Hogan, went into into big mainstream movie roles, you know, Hulk Hogan was the first one who tried it. And I can't think of a Hogan movie that I can say I can watch unironically and enjoy. Like No Holds Barred is a fantastic midnight movie. Suburban Commando is a fantastic midnight movie. Mr. Nanny is one of the most unwatchable movies I think I've ever seen in my life. But both of those cases, though, with Andre the Giant and George the Animal Steel, you know, you had Roddy Piper and They Live before that. But there's not a ton of other properties prior to when Dwayne Johnson went to The Mummy 2.
So The Princess Bride was my number one. Yep, absolutely. Andre the Giant, 1987, Rob Reiner. Still one of my favorite movies of all time. And I had Ed Wood also on my list as well. I, too, like, very much appreciate that movie. Martin Landau won an Academy Award for playing Bela Lugosi from that movie. Like, it's a great movie. I agree. It's a, like, they did a silly, absurd movie that was so very poignant, but also based on a very silly and absurd man. So, yeah, I love both of those movies a ton. Great picks, Mikey.
Ed Wood was also my number one pick. And what's really ironic is George the Animal Steel is a professional wrestler playing a professional wrestler from like three generations before him, which I thought was fascinating.
I will go next if nobody's going to volunteer.
Oh, I guess I'll throw one in there.
No, you didn't volunteer. Too bad.
Sorry, I'll wait.
I'm going to throw one out. I mean, since my favorite was taken in The Princess Bride, you touched on it, Mike. I'm gonna drive it home with They Live, Roddy Piper, John Carpenter, 1988. I mean, look, we would never have the line, "I'm here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum." We would never have that line in our lives if not for the movie They Live, delivered perfectly by Roddy Piper.
If you were a wrestling fan in the 80s, Roddy Piper was the first, I think, truly cool bad guy. And that translated so well what he did in professional wrestling to that role. Like, he did not have to change much at all in what he was, the way he was portraying himself. So that was like a perfectly cast moment in film right there. Cause that's one of those things. Who else could have delivered that line that way?
To me, it's like, when I think about wrestlers and films, it's like, how did they stand out? And do they make the most of their maybe small time on the screen? And I think no one personifies that more than Bonesaw is ready. Maybe the most quoted movie from the Schmodown gang. Back when we were doing the Schmodown, we would do Bonesaw quotes in between commercials to ourselves all the time. Christian Harloff, I think, knows that whole speech, that whole scene, from beginning to end. Hey, freak show, I got you for 3 minutes. It's just like, I love every little word that he says in that, man. It's fantastic. So for me, it's Macho Man Randy Savage and Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, a scene stealer of all scene stealers, and playing an iconic role. Like, that's where Spider-Man in the comics, he fights a wrestler. And, you know, that's how he kind of became Spider-Man. So I think that's a great one. I'm also going to give two smaller recommendations. This guy didn't steal the movie, but every time I watch it, I go back and I watch Over the Top and Roadhouse. The man, Terry Funk, the legend, the wrestling legend, shows up in those movies. He's not like the most charismatic actor, but he had a look and he had a certain tone to him that he stuck out in those movies. Stallone goes to leave the grandfather's house. And he's like, "I'm leaving." And he's like, "He's not done talking to you." And Stallone pushes him through the glass. The music cuts to the arm wrestling. It's amazing. And Roadhouse, he's probably Terry's biggest role is probably in Roadhouse. He's like one of the guys who's in the bar and one of the bouncers. And his character actually has a little bit of an arc throughout the whole film. So for me, Terry the Funk is the legend. And I love when he shows up in the movie because he's just fantastic.
All right. So I have so many movies that I want to talk about in this segment. It's kind of hard to narrow down. So I'm going to start with a movie, and I'm going to caveat this, that this is a god-awful movie. You have to be a very certain kind of human to love this movie. You both have to have a very extensive working knowledge and love of early 1980s wrestling.
I think I know what this is.
And bad 80s movies. And it is a movie called Body Slam, also starring Roddy Piper.
Wow. And
the Barbarian, Captain Lou Albano, and a slew of other early 80s wrestlers. So the essential premise is a indie wrestler is not doing good, so he decides to team up with a hair metal band and go on tour for a rock and wrestling tour to take on the big wrestling promoters. It's so bad. It's so cheesy. But like if you were, it's what's also really weird is like this is during the days of like hard wrestling kayfabe, and you get to see a lot of villain wrestlers playing good guys in the early 80s, which they generally were not allowed to do. So it's just all around. If you have love of those two things, it's worth watching. But if you don't love those two things, don't watch it. It's terrible. The second one, this is a movie that I just watched recently. It is a documentary from last year called Woo, Becoming Ric Flair. It is an amazing documentary. It's one of the better documentaries I've seen. And it's just chronicling like Ric Flair's insane career and life. Like the man was hit by lightning. He had his bowels erupted. He was in a plane crash. He broke his neck. And he just kept going, kept drinking, and refused to stop. It is just a super interesting documentary. And then I will say what I think is probably the best movie that features a large role by a wrestler. And it also features two of the most jacked governors in American history. The Predator, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, with a strong supporting role by Jesse the Body Ventura. You have Arnold, you have Jesse, you have Carl Weathers, you have Oiled Biceps, you have Jean-Claude Van Damme. It is the epitome of pre-90s masculinity.
I believe Jesse Ventura described himself as a sexual Tyrannosaurus.
And he was not wrong.
Also, shout out Jesse Ventura in The Running Man, another Arnold vehicle.
God, there it is.
I think he's got a little bit more of a wrestler type role in that one. He plays this sports entertainment guy. So that's a great choice. I also want to throw some love to Hulk Hogan for Thunderlips, Rocky III. I got to throw that in there as a big Stallone fan. The introduction to a lot of people for Hulk Hogan was not wrestling. It was Rocky III. So, and Mr. T also went on to do wrestling after Rocky III. I think the last thing I really want to mention, and then I'll let you guys take over, Dave Bautista might be the best wrestling turn actor.
Next, yep.
Blade Runner 2049, that opening scene is impressive. It's like a true acting performance. He is given such little time, and he does so much with it. I remember being floored by Bautista in that film. Of course, he's fun in The Guardians, but I also liked him in Glass Onion. I think he is, for my money, the best wrestler turned actor. So I'll just throw that out there.
I did want to throw something out there. You mentioned Jesse the Body Ventura, and it triggered in my mind. Jesse the Body Ventura has the best cameo of any wrestler in any movie of all time in the movie Major League 2 in the trailer for Black Hammer, White Lightning.
Oh, yes.
Yes, with Omar Epps. Yes, the fake trailer. That is a great call. I was going to say Big Show in The Waterboy is also a great cameo by a wrestler. Very funny.
The Big Show also shows up in Jingle All the Way as the giant Santa.
Yeah, you're right. Just watched that. Good. I forgot that was him.
Sorry, go ahead, Benny.
Another iconic Jesse the Body cameo is in the classic Demolition Man with your boy Stallone.
Oh, yeah. Nobody's
going to bring up Devil in the Blue Dress? Come on. He sang Devil with the Blue Dress on. Or no, what is the spoof of Exorcist?
Repossessed.
Yes. He appears with Leslie Nielsen, Jesse the Body Ventura.
Really? Oh, yeah, he sings
Devil with a Blue Dress On.
I don't think I've seen that movie since the 90s, so that's one I'll have to revisit.
And if you guys missed our episode last week, you'll know that John Cena stars in last year's third best movie, Freelance.
Oh, JT, did you watch Freelance?
I was trying to, it wasn't streaming anywhere this I could find right now. So I might have to go through some illegal channels to find it, but I will watch it soon.
Benny, you said you rewatched Dungeons and Dragons. How was it on the second viewing?
I moved it up from a 2.5 out of 5 to a 3 out of 5. I mean, it's a fun fantasy movie, but the CGI, the costuming, it is all atrocious. Like it's a fun story. The cast is good, but the movie I don't think is well done.
Fair.
All right. You know what's real interesting is none of us mentioned The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Maybe the most upset, like, I really don't think he's that good, and I blame his agent in this career path more than anything, because he has never really worked with, like, a great director. He's worked with Michael Bay. He worked with Justin Lin on one of the Fast and Furious. When it comes to his own projects, all the directors he chooses are these kind of, like, no-name workshop kind of guys. Like, he should start working with actually talented directors. Like, Schwarzenegger, one thing you'll give Schwarzenegger, when he became big, he went and found Paul Verhoeven. He went and got teamed up with James Cameron. He worked with actual directors who had a vision and had, you know, something to bring to the material. And I feel like The Rock has just taken that middle of the road, safe, easy direction. And it's really hurt his career, in my opinion.
I did choose a Rock movie that I added to this list, Fighting with My Family, directed by, of all people, Stephen Merchant.
Yeah.
I very much enjoyed that movie. That's the most subdued that The Rock has been, and that is my favorite movie that he's been in. So tossing that out there, I actually did choose The Rock, but I chose it specifically for Fighting with My Family.
And he produced that movie also.
I think The Rock has made some fun movies, but The Rock generally chooses to play The Rock. So he's not really that interesting of an actor outside of a few roles.
Yeah, like, he's good in the Fast and Furious movies, but I didn't like Hobbs and Shaw. Honestly, the Scorpion King might be the best vehicle I've seen him in, because he's just, like, the pure, it's the closest we got to The Rock from what we saw in The Ring. Just throw a sword and a shield in his hand, and it's all about the physicality. I don't think none of the other films he's done since then has really stuck out to me that much. Do you guys agree? Is there anything that really that you're like, oh, that's a great Rock movie?
I enjoy San Andreas. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I literally had this conversation with my wife before we went on. I brought up The Rock. I'm like, what would you say is The Rock's best role? And we were just going through, you know, a lot of his films. I'm like, I enjoyed The Rundown to an extent. It wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. The Jumanji movies are fine. But what everybody says is he's always playing the same thing. Like, you have to look to something bizarre, like Be Cool, where he went off character, very much so off character in that. Or even Southland Tales, which is just one of the most bizarre movies of all time. But that he's not
again supporting. Those are all supporting. And then Benny, you say San Andreas, yeah. But the start of that movie is the effects and the disaster and the huge tidal wave. That's an effects movie that he's in and he's good. But it's not like I don't go to that movie for The Rock. I go for the effects.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I'm not going to any movie to see The Rock act. I'm going to see the action around him.
Yeah, that's why I think Scorpion King, where he actually gets to use his physicality, or the movies like The Fast and Furious, where he gets to use that physicality, I enjoy those. He did a movie called Walking Tall, which is a remake of a 70s film. I actually kind of like that movie because he actually gets to be into action and he uses a physicality. But movies like Jumanji, San Andreas, Hobbs and Shaw, which is a CGI fest, they're not working to his strengths, in my opinion. They're just big effects films that he's plopped in the middle of.
I will like to give a shout out to two more movies before we end this segment, if I can. One, former WWE hardcore champion and ECW heavyweight champion, Al Snow, has a cameo in Rudy, if you happen to like sports movies. Wow. And the second one, I would like to shout out one Rock movie. It's not a good movie, but it's The Race to Witch Mountain. He did a remake of it. And me and my wife went to that movie on one of our first dates. So I will shout that movie out for The Rock.
I've never seen that one. So, and I never saw Journey to the Center of the Earth. So maybe one day I'll check this out. I will give one last cameo, wrestling cameo. Much like Macho Man made the most of his time in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, Hulk Hogan in Gremlins 2, the new batch.
Yeah, sure.
When he delivers Gremlins in here, and he just, like, goes into full Hulkamania mode. I thought that was, like, one of the best cameos. And he addresses the camera. He's like, sorry about that, everybody. Enjoy the movie. That, to me, is one of the best wrestling cameos because it's literally Hulkamania in about 1 minute.
To wrap up my top list, I did have Dave Bautista down, but I had him down for the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. I mean, that was kind of his first like foray into movies. And look, as imposing of a character as Drax the Destroyer could be, they decided to put a very like literal, like fun spin on him, and Bautista nailed it. So I have a special place in my heart for Dave Bautista because I love the Guardians of the Galaxy trilogy. I have Tyler Mane as Sabretooth in the original 2000 X-Men. I thought that was, again, the guy has one, he says one word in the entire movie and that's it. So again, to have that type of a physical presence for a character like Sabretooth, awesome. Way better than Liev Schreiber.
Do you remember what the one line was?
You owe me a scream.
You got it. Good job. Schmodown champion.
Boom. And then lastly, Kevin Nash. I have a soft spot in my heart for the Thomas Jane Punisher.
Kevin Nash
plays the Russian in the Punisher. And so I very much like that as, again, a non-speaking character. So you didn't have to say a word. All you had to do is show up and just be a huge, physically imposing presence. And that's exactly what he was.
But if you're going to use Kevin Nash, why did you not go to Super Shredder from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2?
Holy shit. I totally forgot that that was Kevin Nash. You're absolutely right. He was the Super Shredder.
Wasn't he also Magic Mike?
He wasn't Magic Mike.
Well, he wasn't Magic Mike, but he was
in. No, but he was in Magic Mike, yeah.
Yeah.
You can also shout out the Oscar-winning Ready to Rumble, which featured pretty much the entire 2003 roster of WCW.
And that was Mark Andrako's favorite round three question in Schmodown every time, because that got him like three or four times, if I remember correctly.
Look, as a lover of Oliver Platt, I still find that movie so impossibly hard to believe that he is supposed to be the big top wrestler of the world. Just saying, love you, Oliver Platt. We know you're a fan of the show. We are a huge fan of you. You killed it in The Bear season 2. Just saying, buddy.
A lot of the old NWA champions looked like Oliver Platt in his defense.
Fair. Any honorable mentions, boys, before we go?
I was going to say just, you mentioned Walking Tall. That holds a special place in my heart because I was a movie theater projectionist and that movie was only 4 reels and it was one of the easiest ones I ever had to move from platter to platter. So Walking Tall will always have a special place with Nate.
Nice. Yeah. Johnny Knoxville. I saw that in theaters too. It was entertaining. It was a low budget, low effects driven action movie, which I wish we had more of.
A couple of other documentaries to shout out. The Beyond the Mat was a theatrically released documentary quite a few years ago, but it's excellent. If you're interested in wrestling in the Attitude Era, it's definitely worth checking out. And also, just recently released, there's a documentary on Kurt Angle just called Angle. Also fantastic if you want to give it a chance.
So here's a fun bit of trivia, people. Walking Tall, right, was a remake of a previously featured movie called Walking Tall. Can anybody name the sheriff from the original Walking Tall?
Buford.
Buford T. Justice. That is correct, Benny. Well done. Benny wins the round. And with that, folks, we elevate to round number 3 with our review of The Iron Claw. Stay tuned.
He was out for the count.
I had a heart attack. I can't wrestle no more.
Until he got a second chance.
You should be with your family now.
At life.
What do you want from me?
It's the film of the year. 5 stars. Magnificent.
Your heart.
My heart's still ticking.
The Wrestler. In cinemas now.
Ever since I was a child, people said my family was cursed. Mom tried to protect us with God. Pop tried to protect us with wrestling. He said if we were the toughest, the strongest, nothing could ever hurt us. I believed him. We all did.
You push it too hard.
I'm fine, kid. Seriously, I'm just sick.
I'm scared, man. It all out of control.
What a terrible accident.
I should have stopped him.
I need to think about my family.
Your job is to wrestle. Live up to that deal or we are through.
I told you to look out for him!
I just love being out there with you guys.
It's
The only thing that matters to me.
The greatest family in the history of wrestling.
Welcome back. And now our non-spoiler review of The Iron Claw. Now, in full disclosure, I'm going to sit back and I'm going to enjoy the discussion. I may throw a couple questions in there or two, but I have not yet seen this movie. So I'm going to let JT take the lead because he has. This is his number one movie of 2023, folks. So who better than be able to lead this discussion than the person who appreciated it the most out of all of the movies from last year? Crazy enough. JT, take it away, buddy.
Yeah, I definitely was not expecting this to be my number one film of the year. I had the holdovers for quite a while in that number one spot, and that was Moose's number one film. The 3 days I saw the film up until we recorded our top 10, I originally had Godzilla minus one number two, and I had holdovers number one, and I had Iron Claw number three. And then after a day, I moved Iron Claw above Godzilla. I said, that's my number two. We'll stick with that. Holdovers is number one. And then after another 24 hours, I started thinking about it, and I'm like, I might have to put Iron Claw number one over holdovers. And up to the moment we recorded, it was a real battle for me. But for me, I think the range of emotions I felt watching the Iron Claw kind of get, like I mentioned this in our review, I laugh, I cried, I had tears of joy, I was pumped up, I was excited, I laughed. I just got all the mix of emotions I want from a film. While The Holdovers definitely felt like a warm blanket and even had some emotional moments, I never got my blood pumping like when Rush starts playing and Jeremy Allen White gets in that ring with his brothers. So for me, the movie just kind of encapsulates everything that I loved. I think Zac Efron gives one of the best performances of his career, if not the best performance, because while his role, you would think of a wrestling, someone playing a wrestler is going to be real flashy, over the top. No, he is very reserved, and it even affects him as a wrestler, and it plays into the story, and I think that was really interesting. And I actually, after I watched this movie, I went and I watched a documentary about him and his family and all the things. I was like, I know some things were left out of the film. Benny even mentioned that during our top 10. So the movie actually pushed me to even do more research and watch more documentaries about what happened. And I've listened to interviews with the director, and I think the choices that he made, what he decided to leave out and even combined it into one brother, I think actually really helped the film and the script. And again, listen, not everything is going to be true to life. This is a movie. It's a film. It's not a documentary. Certain things have to be done in order to be make something the most effective film. And the movie just will not leave my head days after watching it. It's a movie that I still think about to this day. It's a movie that I look forward to rewatching and feeling all these emotions again while I'm watching it. Now, a lot of times, you know, we see these movies once, if we're lucky, and it's a movie we really like, we're able to see it more than once before the end of the year. This is a movie I'm really looking forward to rewatching again, see how I feel, see if I still feel like it earned that number one spot. But I feel pretty confident if it didn't, it was in one, two, or three. So it was towards the top. Overall, I think it's a movie for, if you love wrestling, you're going to love this movie. I think if you love human stories and brothers and family, I think you're going to love this movie. There's sometimes when I watch these films, I think, who would I recommend this to? And this is a movie, even if you don't know anything about wrestling, I think I can still recommend this to you because of the human element, the human story, the tragedy. And it feels almost like a, you know, a Shakespearean play at times, but through the, you know, but it's done in the 80s and 70s in the Midwest, and it's just a different era. So to me, I think this is one of the most well-rounded films of the year and one of the most emotionally effective films of the year. It's no movie's perfect. I'm sure there's some criticisms out there that I've heard that I understand where people are coming from, but it's a movie I think you should go see and make up your own mind and see how you feel about it. It's really well made. Even if you don't like the film, if you're not into wrestling, I think just the cinematography, the way it's shot, the score, I think it's done so well on just about every level that you could admire it just for its craftsmanship. So we'll get more into the spoilers, but that's just my overall thoughts on the film. That's why it was my number one film of the year. But I cannot wait to hear what Benny and especially what Mike have to say, because I do not, you guys really know the history of this. I didn't really know more about it until after the movie. I went to my own research. So we'll go to Mike since he's our guest. I know you're excited to talk about this movie. Give us your overall thoughts.
Yeah. So the one thing I wanted to start with is, like, I'm not the type who is what you would just call like an A24 bro. Like, I enjoy the studio, but I don't get drawn in just because A24 is producing something. But when I found out they were doing this story, I was like, oh, that fits like a glove. Like, that got me excited. Knowing what this story was, I knew it was going to be, that was the correct studio to be making a movie like this. For like a backstory, like, I became a wrestling fan in 1989, and up until about 2001 is when I fell off. But the big thing with me, most of this movie, if you realize, the bulk of it fell before that. Almost all of everything that happens in the movie, with the exception of about the last 20 minutes, really takes place before that. I was fortunate enough growing up, and all of you will remember this when I bring it up. ESPN had the contract for World Class Championship Wrestling, which is the promotion that it's based around. During the day, ESPN needed to fill a lot of content, so they would replay all of these old wrestling events and stuff during the day, because they didn't have your Stephen A. Smiths and Pat McAfee's at that time. They needed to fill content. And when I first got into it, I got to rewatch all of this old classic footage, which, you know, it wasn't too old, but it was nice that I had the background on that. And I never knew too much about the actual story of what happened off screen with most of the Von Erichs family. So in 2006, WWF or WWE acquired all of the old footage from World Class Championship Wrestling. They made a documentary on it. At the time, it aired on Netflix. Now you can find it on Peacock. If you were to watch that, I would definitely recommend after the fact, if you don't know the story, because my viewing of the movie versus I went with my wife the first time and my parents, we all went out and saw it. And none of them knew the story. I knew the story. So there were some beats that really hit them harder, which I knew was coming. There were still plenty of beats in this movie that hit me hard, even though you knew what was about to happen. But I would definitely recommend this as a companion piece after the fact, just the way that you did at JTE, in that you're going to learn it's not just what's portrayed in the movie, but even more. But my overall thought before we go into spoilers, though, is a lot of movies last year in particular were kind of chastised for being bloated. Like, their runtime seemed a little too long. This one, I think, was almost perfect. Like, they did not have a lot of wasted space in this movie at all. It flowed really well. Yes, I can understand if you're a diehard wrestling fan being like, well, they left this out. Well, they left this out. They had to, in order to create a movie narrative. And I thought what they chose to leave in and what they left out worked. It really did make sense from a narrative perspective. The performances in this movie are fantastic. We'll get into that more in the spoiler talk. This movie hit on so many levels, and I'll let Benny say his non-spoiler thoughts, but this was a movie that really, for me, understood what this content was supposed to be and treated it with respect.
Yeah, well said. I agree with you. It flew by for me. I had no point in my, you know, looking at my watch or my thinking this could have ended 15 minutes early. It ended. It felt like a perfect runtime. But let's go to Benny. Benny, you had this, I think, number 5 on your list, the top 10. Am I correct?
Yes, I did. And I will say this. If I would recommend this movie more to you if you are a non-wrestling fan than if you are a wrestling fan from that era. Like, if you judge this movie solely on, I'm going in to watch this drama, it is a beautiful movie. It's well-crafted. The performances are great. It flows great. There are really only a couple nitpicks, which I can talk about in the spoiler things, that if you're just judging this movie in and of itself, it is an immaculate modern drama, you know, and it's got powerful subject matter. I'll say this, if you are like me that has some of my very early memories, you know, growing up or watching wrestling, and I do remember when I was really young seeing Kevin Von Erich wrestle, you know, his brother Kerry was one of my favorite wrestlers when I was a little kid, when he was the Texas Tornado in the WWF. And, you know, and I remember Harley Race, Ric Flair, a lot of those guys. And so the only reason this movie was number 5 is because I am comparing it to my memories and I'm seeing where it falls short related to my memories. So, and that's not really necessarily a fair judgment on this movie, But I think if you're someone that has powerful memories of that era of wrestling, it's hard for you to disconnect some of those things. But if you're not a wrestling fan, but you love drama, or if you're a modern wrestling fan, I think this movie will land on you like a ton of bricks in a good way. It's a beautiful movie.
Yeah, well said, Benny. And I think that's interesting to have your guys' perspective on that, because I am the one who, I knew there was tragedy, but I didn't know what the tragedies were. And my mouth was open several times during this movie, like, oh my God, like, what's going to happen next? Like, what more can this family endure? So I think we all basically gave our general thoughts. I think we should move into spoilers, because there's several things I really want to touch on. Not all of it's spoilers, but it's very specific things. First of all, Zac Efron, unbelievable, unrecognizable. Is there exercises you could do for your chin? Because the man looked like the bad guy from Tango and Cash. I don't even know what that guy's name is. But if you know what I'm talking about, he looked, when you say an actor transforms his body, he transforms his body. I could not believe it was Zac Efron. I'm saying to myself, are there part prosthetics? Like, what is going on here? I give him a lot of credit. Not since Rocky IV have I seen a single actor change his body into something that looks unattainable. Unattainable. So I got to give a lot of shout out to that. Benny, I have a quick question for you. So I actually went back and watched some of the old Ric Flair videos of around this time and era. And I know there was some criticism that the Ric Flair in this movie wasn't that good. I think he looks pretty damn close to what Ric Flair was like back in the day. And I think he does a pretty good job. And I feel like maybe I'm in the minority, but I thought he did pretty good as a Ric Flair. Not the Ric Flair we knew from WWE or WWF, but if you go to this time specific Ric Flair, I think the actor did a pretty good job.
So I will say when the actor playing Ric Flair walks into the dressing room, and he's like, yes, where can you go get fucked up in this town? Right there, he is being Ric Flair.
Yep.
What he is doing in the promos and what he is doing in the ring, he is someone doing almost a comedic parody of what Ric Flair was doing then. And that's what bothered me about it. But when he actually walked into that dressing room, in that scene, he was good, but the other just outweighed it. And I would say out of the two, like, other big name wrestlers from that era that you really get to spend any time with, actually Harley Race is more problematic for me than Ric Flair. Like, the guy doesn't look too far off from Harley Race in his physical appearance, but, you know, even if you remember Harley Race from his WWF days, which was way when he was way past his prime, he was still like an intimidating figure, even though he was like a 60-year-old man who was clearly out of shape. And that actor, he never brought that. I never once felt like this is a guy that should be imposing to the Von Erich brothers. And that was really sad for me, because like the Harley Race was an intimidating dude.
Yeah, and that's the difference between somebody who's going in with that information and knowing that wrestler, to me, who I never even heard of him. And I'm just like, oh yeah, he worked. It worked for me, because I'm not comparing him to my memories and what I grew up with. So it's an interesting fact. There's definitely a scene towards the end I really want to touch into, but is there anything in the first half of the movie that you guys want to talk about? Any scenes that really stuck out to you?
I would have liked them, like, and then this is just like another thing. I would have liked them to spend a little more time with like the fallout from the second oldest brother Mike's death, because that was a big deal in Texas at the time. And I felt that they didn't give that enough time. So when we talk about runtime, the movie flows really great. But as another thing, is like somebody that knows these stories, I'm like, you should have given me a little more of that. And, you know, in the movie they could, and I understand it works for the movie. But like, again, if you know these little beats that are missing, you're like, man, I wish I could have got another 10 minutes of that.
Yeah, I know. In some ways, I'll just say this, and then I'll go to you, Mike. In some ways, I feel like the movie is saying something about this family. These tragedies happen, and they kept going. They didn't sit and stew in it. They were almost to a point where it's not healthy. It wasn't healthy the way these things, these tragedies would happen. And the family's like, we got to go get the belt. We got to go do a show. Like, the father is this, you know, monarch of this family, and he is the worst, like, you know, sports dad of any movie you would ever see. He is putting everything above his family, his goals, his dreams, and he's pushing onto his son. So I understand what you're saying, Benny. I think the documentary I watched definitely made a better job of showing how big of a deal it was when he passed away. But I do think the film touched on it enough for me, especially after watching the documentary. But I also think it's part of the mindset of the movie. But that's just my take. Mike, go ahead.
So one thing I was going to mention was, like, it jumped into the chronology. Like, Kevin's already established that he's a wrestler and everything. There's actually a really funny story about Kevin that I thought they were going to put in the movie to add some levity. One thing a lot of people probably question this is, like, why the hell did he not wear shoes when he wrestled? And the answer to that is that somebody played a prank on him and hit his boots one night, and he had to go out there without them. And he's like, joke's on you, I enjoyed that, and just continued doing it. I'm like, I thought going into the movie, that was something that could have been like a moment of levity. But I'm like, oh, they started past that. That was one thing, like, knowing the history of it, I thought they had an opportunity there. But they started with the opening scene with Fritz, the very opening scene, you know, when they're doing the intro credits, and you see how intense Fritz is, sets the tone for what you were talking about. In terms of, this guy is so hellbent about the career and especially bringing the NWA title to Texas that it drains his life. Like, he buys a car he can't afford because he thinks it's going to attract the NWA to bringing the championship to Texas. Mm-hmm. What a lot of people don't realize, if you weren't around wrestling at that time, the NWA was not just one promotion. It was a series of regional promotions, and they had one champion. So whatever promotion got the champion from that got a lot more recognition. They got a lot more money. That particular performer would then proceed to go around the country and even around the world. But world class, up until the point that they wound up putting it on Kerry after David's death, did not ever have that champion. It was usually the Georgia-based promotion, Jim Crockett, that had it, which is where Ric Flair, Harley Race, Dusty Rhodes was out of Florida. Most of them were where it came from, and World Class never had that opportunity. And that's why Fritz was so hellbent throughout the movie. He constantly talks about bringing the belt home. The movie didn't really go into that in depth, and I understand that. That's something that's not necessarily important, but if you understand what that meant at that time, you know, it brings an extra layer to the movie.
Yeah, everything you just said right there, I was a little lost. So I'm curious how they would have portrayed that in the movie. I think that if you had explained all that,
yeah,
it might have taken away from the emotional and the character moments. But I think there probably would have been a way to do that and maybe get you more vested. Because the weird thing this movie does, it kind of treats wrestling, if you don't know that it's fake, you could watch this movie and not know it's fake. They treat it almost more like a boxing sports movie where, like, oh, we have to, they don't tell you that, oh yeah, you know, this is who's going to win. There's even times where movie it feels like I'm like, they know who's going to win going into this match, because it seems like they're playing it like they don't know, but I know wrestling's all predetermined before they go in. But they do cover certain aspects of wrestling, like the fact that the main character is not a good mic guy. He's not good at cutting promos. Mm-hmm. And the fact that his brother leapfrogs him for the title shot because he has athletic ability, but he had the promo skills, he had the mic skills. And I loved seeing the family dynamic of these brothers kind of being played against each other by their father, and basically they all just want their father's approval. They want to, you know, do what's right for him and be the best of the brothers. And in some ways the father was kind of, you know, no bullshit, he would play it against each other. He even says at one point he ranks his kids. He's like, you're my favorite, you're a second, you're a third, you're the fourth. Psychologically, for a kid, that is traumatizing. To hear you're number four out of the four brothers, you're your father's fourth favorite. And that he's even says, you know, hey, that's the ranking now, but you can leapfrog him, you can be my number one. Like, the psychological drama that these kids are putting through is not healthy. But one thing the film, I think, does a great job of, and I think we're going to talk about the ending in a little bit, you have to care about these brothers, and you have to care about the relationship, and you have to care about the bond they have as brothers. And the film does such a good job of doing that. that when the ending hits, it hits. The payoff is there. We'll get into that a little bit more. But is there anything in the, like, you guys want to cover before we kind of start going towards the whole tragic ending?
Well, what you mentioned there, the dynamic of the brothers is what made this movie as gave it the heart that it had. As I rewatched the movie the second time, and I really paid a lot of attention, there is several moments in the movie, especially watching it a second time, where there is foreshadowing with some of the events that are about to happen. And if they didn't have the dynamic between the brothers, some of it happens with what you're talking about with the leapfrogging, and some of it is foreshadowing what's going to inevitably happen to the characters. But the one thing with the brothers is it's Kevin who's the one who always is, he was there to start with, and then he gets leapfrogged by David, and then he gets leapfrogged by Carrie, and then Carrie has to rebuild himself, and he's kind of responsible for that, and then he has to carry Mike, and it's, the whole movie is Kevin because of his, you know, perceived limitations as a talker, that he's really great as a performer in the ring, but he doesn't get the recognition because he's not as entertaining necessarily as his brothers were. And it's something that to this day, like if you were to listen to Kevin, and Kevin's done a lot of press recently, you know, it's not too difficult to find content with Kevin Von Erich at the moment. He's a pretty down-to-earth, just normal dude. He's not an over-the-top character. And that kind of held him back when you're talking about people like Ric Flair. And even his brother, David, was super charismatic. And Kerry Von Erich, you know, he's – all of them are over-the-top, bigger-than-life people, whereas Kevin's just your average, you know, everyday guy for the most part.
Yeah, Benny, anything you want to mention before we start getting to the third act?
No, one thing when you're talking about Zac Efron's like transformation, like this struck me odd. Like what he did for this movie, like physically transforming, is amazing.
It's insane.
But what's odd is like, and maybe my memories are a little lax here, but Kevin Von Erich was a really lean.
He was.
Yeah, and like his brothers, you know, well, not the second oldest one, but like Carrie, he was a hulking giant, you know. But Kevin Von Erich was a really slender, looked like Zac Efron normally looks kind of guy. So I even though like his physical transformation is amazing, I always kind of wondered why he did that, because he already kind of looked like Kevin Von Erich's physique ahead of time. But anyway, maybe that's just like a side thing.
Yeah, it could have been just to show don't tell. So basically, this is the most physically fit, most talented wrestler out of these brothers, but he doesn't have all those other attributes that a WCW wrestler needs to be the top guy. He had the physicality. There's no question about that. You stack Zac Efron against these other brothers, it's night and day, in my opinion. He is an athlete. But even though he had those athletic skills, he didn't have all the intangibles to be the number one guy. Moose, did you want to throw a question at us?
Yeah. Hi, Mark from Moose Times here.
yes. Please go ahead.
I do have a question. So this movie was directed by Sean Durkin. And before this, he has a very, very limited resume. He directed The Nest in 2020 with Carrie Coon and Jude Law. Never heard of it. Never seen it. And he directed a 2011 movie called Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, starring Elizabeth Olsen.
Correct.
Those movies don't strike me as action-oriented, as like a wrestling movie about four brothers and a professional wrestling environment, right? So you guys obviously are giving this guy props for like his direction, but how does like the wrestling scenes in this movie compare to what we would just see like in a normal wrestling TV show?
I admit for that.
Yeah, I'll give this to Mike and Benny because I think they're the ones who are probably better off. All I'll say to that, Moose, is I did see Marcy, May, Marlene in theaters when it came out, and it's a beautifully shot movie, and it is all about psychological people dealing with psychological and emotional manipulation, and I think that did apply a little bit to this movie. But as far as the wrestling action, I have my opinion, but I'd love to hear what Mike and Deacon have to say.
So what this happened, if you remember a few years back on Netflix, they had the Glow, based on the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling from the 80s.
And oh, sure. Yep.
So the same professional wrestler, his name is Chavo Guerrero Jr., who choreographed and trained all of the actors for Glow, did it for this. So they had an actual professional wrestler. His name is Chavo Guerrero Jr., who he appears briefly in the movie as one of Zac Efron's opponents. But he was there on site as like a consultant and was literally training all the actors to do this. And they also had another professional wrestler who played a character that basically got cut in the movie. His name is Lance Von Erich, who they brought in when after the other brothers had started passing away because they wanted the name to live, but he actually was not a brother. They kind of omitted that from the movie. He's in the movie for about 5 seconds. It's a blink and you'll miss it. But the name of the wrestler is Maxwell Jacob Friedman. So the two of them, him and Chavo Guerrero, were there the entire time to serve as like coaches for everybody. So yes, they did make things look realistic. And they said when they filmed this, it was actually more intense than a lot of regular wrestling is because they had to repeat it over and over to get different angles, to get different takes. Whereas, if you watch the actual original match, it might be 10 minutes. They might've spent a half hour, an hour redoing everything to film this. So it was, they said in a lot of ways was more grueling than what regular wrestling would be.
Benny, did it work for you?
It did. The wrestling is a backdrop in this movie. Like, even though it's a movie about wrestlers, the wrestling is not something in the forefront. When they do show it, it is very good. But like one thing to keep in mind is like wrestling from that period is much less polished than the wrestling that you see today. So it's actually probably looks better than the actual wrestling from that time period did. Because like I said, it nowadays it's almost like a gymnastics performance art where it necessarily was not back in that time frame. So the wrestling actually looks better than it did when you actually watch it from that time period.
Last question for you guys as before you guys go into more spoiler territory. I'm not a wrestling fan. It just didn't come to me at the right point in my life. And by the time it did, I had pretty much moved past wanting to get involved into it. As a non-wrestling fan, will I enjoy this as a drama?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
100%. Yes. All right. So I want to get to a big spoiler. I want to get to one of the last scenes of the film because this, to me, is what elevated this movie from maybe in my top five to my number one. And in the moment that it happened, I wasn't sure it was going to work. And I almost said to myself in the theater, oh, no. I don't know if this is going to work. This might ruin the movie. So one of the last brothers to pass away is Jeremy Allen White. Mm-hmm. He writes a suicide note, which apparently was exactly what he wrote in real life. He's like, I don't want to be in this world anymore. I just want to be with my brothers. Once his body is found by Zac Efron, we go into a scene where we are in the afterlife. Jeremy Allen White is now alive. He's walking. It's like sunset.
And he has his foot back.
And he has his foot back. He loses his foot earlier in the movie. And so you know that this is either a flashback. I don't know what I'm looking at here. And then as he makes his way to this pond, there's a dock. And the two other brothers who had passed away earlier in the film are waving to him. And I'm like, okay, this is basically an afterlife scene. This is him saying, you know, in his suicide note, I want to be with my brothers. And instead of just leaving it there, which would have been a very sad and depressing ending, they film a scene of Jeremy White reuniting with his brothers, even to the point where they mentioned earlier in the film that Zac Efron's character is the oldest brother, but he in fact was not the oldest brother. He had another brother who died when he was like 5 or 6 years old, really young. And there's a scene where Jeremy Allen White meets his brothers, and then a child comes out, and that's his older brother, and he picks him up. And the way the actors embrace each other, the director told them to don't touch each other like your brothers, where, you know, in the movie, they're always kind of wrestling around, pushing each other. It is a very touching and like loving scene of family members embracing each other. Now, when this scene first started, I said, oh, I don't know if this is going to work. What's he doing right now? I was like, are we really going here? But by the end of the scene, I had tears in my eyes. I felt overcome with like joy and love. And it made the movie, which is very hard to watch, very depressing at times, very, you know, it's a tragedy. For 90% of the movie, you're watching a tragedy. To have this moment of just of a release of joy and love and, like, seeing these characters together after you've seen this whole film and what they've been through, it kind of put the movie over the top for me. And it's one of my favorite scenes of the year. When you just said, like, what was the most touching scenes of the year? To me, it's this scene. I've heard other critics say they had the same worries that I did, that when the scene started, they thought, oh, no, I don't know if the director's going to be able to pull this off. But I think he pulled it off. Did that scene work for you guys? Did you have the same worry that I had when it first started? Or were you on board right away? And did it give you that feeling that you were kind of be missing the whole time you're watching this movie? There's so many questions I'm asking them all right now. So we'll start with Benny, then we'll go to Mike. Benny, what did you think of the scene?
I appreciated the scene. I think the movie needed that scene, because without that, like, all of these people that we've spent time with through this whole movie, with the exception of Kevin, you almost have to view them like with a sense of pity. Mm-hmm. And this gave you another light. So I think it added another depth to them, to the characters. And I think it's needed, or the movie would have just been too heavy. So I didn't have any real apprehension with there being an afterlife scene. And I think it was needed just to give you a different side of those characters, so they weren't just pathetic's not the right word, but just, you know, they made them more than just a cautionary tale.
So for me, though, this really, with the scene that follows it, when I watched it the second time, it really hit harder the second time when I knew to expect the afterlife scene. The afterlife scene happens, and it's bookended with Kevin carrying Jeremy Allen White's body into the house. And you just see Kevin is completely wrecked. But then you have Carrie in the afterlife, who has found his peace and he's with his brothers. And then you go to the very next scene. And the very next scene is Kevin just completely broken down and his kids playing football, as Kevin and his brothers were doing earlier in the film. And the kids see him and he's like, I'm not a brother anymore. And his kids say, well, we'll be your brothers. That's the point that I was like, ooh, I just got punched in the chest. I just lost the breath. All came out of me. That was that line right there. I was like, wow, that just hit me right where it was. And that whole scene, when you take everything surrounding all the circumstances for it, was one of the more powerful scenes in any movie I think I saw last year.
Yeah, listen, when you finish strong like that on an emotional level, it's the movie goes up a few points in my book. You know, like, you can have a great movie, but if you stick the landing, that's what makes a, you know, a very good movie a great movie in a lot of ways for me. I can't help but be reminded of another great wrestling film, The Wrestler.
Yes.
A character study, that was my favorite film of the year. Two wrestling movies, both made my number one of the year. And I'm not even the biggest wrestling guy, but these movies are about the characters and about what they're going through. And if the end speech that Mickey Rourke gives in The Wrestler does not touch you, and then when he's on those ropes, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's an emotion. Your heart, your eyes tear up. This movie did the same thing for me. By the end of this movie, that line from Zac Efron, who gives a great performance throughout the movie, but really that last scene kind of goes into another gear. And when he goes, I used to be one of like four or five brothers, and now now I have no brothers. And like you said, the kids are like, oh, don't cry, Dad. We'll be your brothers. And, you know, you see the emotion that Zac Efron is going through his face. He sells it so well. And, yeah, I feel like I could go on for another 45 minutes about this movie. I can't wait to watch it again. I'll be watching it the second it starts streaming, or the second the 4K release comes out, or Blu-ray, whatever physical media comes out. I will own it and I will watch this movie. This and The Wrestler would be a great doubleheader. Watch this first and watch The Wrestler. It's a lot of heartbreak and a lot of emotion, but I think they complement each other in some ways because they're two different eras. And I think they both portray those eras in very different ways.
Jesus, you need like a recovery movie after that double.
Yeah,
right.
No,
there.
Listen, like, it's a tough
holdover.
Body slam.
Yeah, the holdovers there.
But very much like The Wrestler, like in the middle of the movie, The Wrestler, like it's entertaining. Like there's fun moments and there's fun to be had with this movie too. When they really get into the wrestling in this movie and the brothers are kind of firing on all cylinders, it's a fun movie at times. Like you get caught up in the audience, the music, the wrestling matches. You can see why they're, you know, people love wrestling back in those days. So I guess we can just do final thoughts on the movie and then we'll call it a night. Real quick before we do our final thoughts, Moose, is there anything else you wanted to ask or add?
No, thank you.
Perfect. Well, Mike, I guess I'll let you give your overall thoughts first.
Yeah, this movie definitely hit on so many levels. I agree with a lot of what Benny said in that I think this is going to hit people who don't know the story way harder than people who do. But the people who do will also have a great appreciation of how it was presented. Yes, there are nitpicks to be made if you're somebody who grew up, you know, as a diehard fan of the whole industry and everything. And there are a lot of changes that were made and things that were omitted. But what they do present to us here is one of the best dramas past several years. It's been a long time since you've seen a family related sports drama like this that really hits you as hard as it does. It's a wonderful watch. It's a hard watch, but very highly recommended on my end.
Go ahead, Benny.
Yeah, I would say, and it's something I reiterate, like, any flaws that you find in this movie, that I find in this movie, I should say, they are not this movie's fault. This movie is an immaculate drama. The only faults are when I compare it to my memories and it doesn't line up with those exactly, but that's not this movie's fault. The movie is great. And that being said, I would really like to see the team behind this movie do a mini series about the NWA and just like the wrestlers during that time frame. I would pay so much money for that.
I think they already made an NWA movie. I think it was Ice Cube's son starred in it. And
yeah, Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah, F. Straight Outta Compton. Gray. That's what it was called. Yeah, they already made that movie.
Peabody in that one.
Yeah, there you go. Listen, these guys are wrestling experts. I just came to this as a movie, and it became my number one movie of the year. I think that, like, I'll just we say again that last scene, because the movie, even though it's fun and heartwarming at times, it plays out as a tragedy. And if I didn't have that last scene, I don't know if this movie would have been my number one, because it would have been just a bummer of a time at the movies. It would have been interesting, it would have been fascinating and depressing. But having that emotional payoff at the end, which only pays off because of the love that is established between these brothers, you feel every loss. And when those losses start building up on top of each other, it almost becomes unbearable as you're watching it. And then to get that reunion in the afterlife brings it all back, and it pays off all that tragedy, pays off all that despair that builds up throughout this film. There's a release valve at the end. And that release valve is the fact that that one brother got to live a great life afterwards. And to see those brothers reunited, just picture perfect for me. So, yeah, that was why it was my number one movie of the year. That's going to do it. And I'll let Moose do the outro.
Well, of course, we do have to thank our very good friend, Mike Deacon. Mike, we've had your wife on last year. We had you on this year. You guys are always welcome back on the show. Please select a movie coming out in 2024. We would love to have you both on the show. But please tell everyone listening where they can find more of the Deacon.
Yeah. So on Tuesday nights, you can find me on the Notorious by Chance channel on YouTube alongside Chance Ellison and Jacob Lemon. We have a football-related show called Left Side Strong Side. Moose and JTE have both been on it before. On Wednesday nights, I have my own show, which is What the Show Podcast, alongside Bethany Deacon, my wife, Justin the Juice, and AJ Lancaster. Everybody here has been on that multiple times. I will also give a plug to my wife and Betty's wife. Bethany and Sarah have started a new show on the Last American Heroes channel that's going to be – they've done their pilot episode. It's going to be called Know It or Blow It, and it's going to be a little bit of a different take on trivia competition. So, yeah, that's coming soon.
I officially challenged JTE to Know It or Blow It.
To Know It or Blow It? I thought that was like a game that Benny played. Like, how drunk are you, Benny? You know it or blow it into the breathalyzer.
He plays that every night on the on the Ohio PD channel.
There you go. No, well, airplane.
You know, that's next week review, believe it or not. No, next week, folks, stick around. We will be reviewing The Beekeeper. Statham is at it again. Crikey. I don't know. Maybe Statham's from Australia, I guess. But
it's got to be better than his last effort.
Let's certainly hope so. But
Meg too, yeah.
That's great. I'm talking about Expendables, whatever.
Benny will still continue to approve and support the Meg 2 while the rest of us are desperately trying to drink enough alcohol to force it out of our brains. But anyhow,
wait a minute, Moose, question goes to you. Meg 2 or Expendables 4?
Now, I'll watch Meg 2 all day. It's got a giant shirt.
Oh, okay.
I don't have to watch the god-awful performances in Expendables.
All right, I'll give you that.
Yeah, I'll take a giant shark eating. Like, if a giant shark came up and it was the Expendables versus the Meg 2, that may be the greatest movie of last year, but nah, opportunity.
Now that's a movie. Expendables versus Meg? Yes, I'm in.
But on that, folks, we are going to call it a day. Thank you for tuning in. Have a good night, everybody. Cheers.
Good night, everybody.